How did you come to be interested in energy and working upon energy issues?
Well, I trained in Canada as a nuclear physicist, and initially I knew nothing about nuclear engineering, but in the late 1960s, a Canadian friend of mine introduced me and my wife to a whole new idea that had just emerged on the west coast of Canada and the U.S. called something the environment. And we got very interested in this and very concerned about it. And as it happened, one of the things that was then a considerable concern to people who were interested in the environment was the issue of nuclear energy as a civil energy.
Yeah.
I mean, people had been worried about weapons since the 1950s, but they began to get worried about civil nuclear electricity as an issue in itself, whether it was safe enough, whether they would be able to manage the radioactive waste from it, and of course, eventually, whether it could actually be afforded, because it turned out to be very, very expensive. So I got involved in this. I got invited. I went to the 1972 United Nations Conference on the Human Environment in Stockholm, which was the first so-called mega conference, which had tens of thousands of people from countries all over the world at this enormous conference. And my colleagues and I published an independent daily newspaper at the conference talking about what was going on behind the scenes, who was doing what to what, how they were screwing each other around and so on. And it was the first conference that the Chinese had come to after they took up their seat at the United Nations. And they arrived at the conference and told the organizers that they didn't like the approach that the organizers had been doing for 2 years and had a completely different idea about what they wanted out of the conference. And so the organizers were in a panic, of course, immediately, and they set up a secret session at the conference negotiating with the Chinese delegates about a different so-called declaration on the human environment that was going to come out of the conference. And we had a mole. My team, my colleagues, we called our newspaper the Stockholm Conference Echo, ECO. And we had a mole in the secret session. And halfway through the conference, we published a daily copy of our newspaper with a big headline saying China declares, and publishing most of the text of the alternative Chinese declaration on the human environment. And we sat back and waited, because there were probably 400 or 500 different media people there from newspapers and television all over the world, and not one of them picked it up. And on Monday, we were confirmed correct on the beginning of the second week. And from then on, our editorial conference in the delegates' lounge were 4 deep in journalists, because they wanted to know what's happening today, what's the inside story today. And it was great fun. We got back from the conference, and the newly formed British organization called Friends of the Earth asked me if I would like to join the staff, because they'd been the people who organized this newspaper. And I went back and said to my late beloved wife, I told them what they had in mind, and they said that, and they're going to pay us, I think it was £1,500 a year.
Wow.
A year. And even in 1972, that was not a lot of money.
Mm.
But my wife, who was a very hardworking dentist, said, well, Walt, this is something that needs to be done, and you can do it, and if you want to do it, I'll back you. And she did.
Oh, wow.
And so I became I became what turned out to be the first so-called energy campaigner for Friends of the Earth.
Wow.
And in the course of which time, we had a long-running battle with what was then called British Nuclear Fuels about their plans to build a huge new plutonium plant at Sellafield. And I wrote and published a Penguin book called Nuclear Power, which came out in 1976. And by the time it was finally out of print, it had sold about 130,000 copies in English and also come out in 5 other languages. And that book is now on my website as a free download. And although the last edition of the book came out in a week before they blew up Chernobyl in 1986, it still gets downloaded a couple of thousand times a month from my website.
That's brilliant.
Which is really very gratifying.
So you're one of the sort of pioneers.
I think that's fair. Yeah, I think that's fair. I was certainly in the first wave of environmental troublemakers in the UK.
So we'll move on to the next question, which sort of goes with your sort of story of how things have changed, and it's that in the past, people couldn't take energy for granted. They couldn't take electricity for granted. They'd have to walk miles to get their water. It wouldn't just come out of a tap. But now it sort of seems that young people do take it for granted.
Now, young people in rich countries like ours do, yes. And of course, that doesn't apply on a lot of the world. There are well over a billion people that don't have access to electricity.
Mm. But in these countries where it is taken for granted,
yeah.
Do you have an opinion on how this could be addressed?
Yeah, which is, of course, one of the reasons why I've written this new book. Because I think we tend to assume that what we're interested in is what people call energy, what politicians and commentators call energy. When they use the word energy, they actually mean fuel and electricity. They don't actually. I like to call myself a lapsed nuclear physicist, and so I was trained as a hard scientist. And to me, energy is the unifying principle of the universe. Energy is an absolutely fundamental concept. It's not oil and coal and coal and gas and electricity.
Mm-hmm.
It is much more profound than that. And we have degraded the word. But then we spend all our time talking about supplies of fuel and electricity without actually thinking about what actually does what we want to do. Humans do six things. In physical terms, humans do six things. We control heat flow. We adjust temperatures up and down. We make light. We exert forces. We move things. And we manage information. And we do that with physical artifacts, with things like lamps and motors and ultimately, of course, like buildings. And those are the things that provide what we want, like comfort and illumination and motive power and so on. And those are the really important things. And the interesting thing about it is that if you have, for example, a really good lamp or a really good motor, it needs a lot less electricity to do what you want to do. So there is a trade-off between the quality of the things and the amount of the process, that either the in the book I talk about the two processes that we use are fire and electricity. And of course we grew up with fire. Our Neanderthal precursors had fire. So we've evolved with fire and we take it for granted and we think of it as a very cozy, welcoming sort of phenomenon. But it's actually, in physical terms, a violent, extreme process. It produces heat at a temperature that's dangerous. It turns resources into waste very fast.
Mm.
And the waste is often pernicious, either locally or globally. I mean, that's why you can't breathe in Beijing and why governments are arguing over the Arctic seabed, feeding fire, and why we're worried about what's been happening to the weather because of what comes out of the fire.
Mm.
And at the same time, for the past century and a bit longer, we've actually found that we can do all the things we want to do using not fire, but electricity. So we make lamps, we make light with electricity, we drive motors with electricity, and especially we manage information with electricity. But the problem at the moment is that we still make way too much of the electricity with fire.
Yeah.
So, but we don't have to. Right from the beginning, when we started using electricity, we found that we could make it with water wheels or wind turbines, or, you know, they didn't call them turbines then, but and now, of course, we have all these other options, including particularly solar photovoltaics, which are completely different from the way we started making electricity. Back when Edison and company started making electricity, they used steam engines and water wheels to turn the dynamo. And the thing that was interesting about that is that the bigger the piece of kit, the cheaper the electricity. There was something called economies of scale. So they kept on building them bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually they had to make them farther and farther and farther away until they were enormous. But it turned out that being enormous also meant that they were very complicated, prone to breakdown, very expensive, and they took a hell of a long time to build. So, and then all of a sudden we found that we could do this differently. Starting in the early say the late 50s and then through the early 60s and so on, we started to realize that a better power station, instead of being bigger and farther away, might actually be smaller and closer to where you wanted to use it. Mm-hmm. Until we've gotten to the point now where your house can be your power station. Mm-hmm. You know, it can have your photovoltaics on the roof and a fuel cell in the basement, and you generate your own electricity. The batteries are starting to get better and cheaper, and in a lot of places now, this is causing terrible problem for traditional electricity companies because their customers are leaving.
It's interesting you're talking about companies
and
the economy, because I think that's where our next question is going to lead.
Okay.
Benita's going to ask you some questions about that.
Well, the first question I'm going to ask is, in your view, what is the relationship between energy and the economy?
This is very interesting, because when you say that, you mean by energy, you mean specifically fuel and electricity, the different fuels and electricity and the economy. And there is a curious fixation on this, because for so long they have been very major factors in the economy. I mean, our pension funds depend at the moment on companies who are regarding their fossil fuel reserves as an important asset. Well, of course, you now know that there is a lot of concern that maybe this is going to turn out to be a stranded asset, because we know that we can't possibly burn all the fossil fuels that we have already available if we want to keep the planet livable. And so there is a disconnect between the way we value these processes and how we feed them and their actual effect on the economy. So that, for instance, as I said earlier, we evolved with fire. We have never accurately costed its consequences. We take for granted the fact that fire makes megacities almost uninhabitable. You can't breathe in big cities because of the fire in furnaces and car engines and factories and power stations. And yet we don't account for that. That doesn't become part of the cost. Even though now insurance companies are starting to get very, very worried about the actual physical cost of the consequences of using fire. Because it is now getting to the point where, well, you see, for example, in California at the moment, you have an entire state which is getting practically bone dry, which is, from their point of view, very scary. But it's a consequence of what's been happening to the snow melt on the Rocky Mountains. Mm. Normally, the snow keeps the water and releases it gradually, so that they have a nice the water that falls in the winter, so that they have water when the rain isn't falling in the summer. But now the snow's all melted, and the snow is not there to keep the water for them, so that they still get water in the winter, but they don't get very much in the summer, and they're in trouble.
So the
way people do the analysis for the economy is missing a lot of really important costs, and the costs are often associated with fire and the fuel we use to feed it.
Just more specific, because what you said was really interesting, but I was thinking, why do you think, there's this drive to use fossil fuels? Why do you think this way of using it is still embedded within us?
Partly it's inertia. Partly it's just first and foremost, it's a way of thinking. It's what you could call a mindset. For generations, this is what we have done. Ever since the invention, particularly the invention of the steam engine, since then, from that point on, with the availability of being able to exert force with fire, that suddenly transformed the way we made things. Suddenly, we were able to make things instead of having individual artisans and craftspeople making things one at a time, we could produce them in enormous quantity, and they were a lot cheaper. Partly because we didn't take into account some of the consequences of using the fire, and also because we certainly didn't take into account the consequences of the effect on people, because in the early factories, the working conditions were absolutely execrable. Again, a lot of the economic corollaries of what we're talking about are simply that we don't do the costings accurately. We don't actually take into account how much something costs, not only immediately and how much you pay for it, but what impact it has on people's lives, what impact it has on the way you you know, your surroundings, what impact it has on the ecological systems that keep the planet habitable.
I think that thing about it becoming suddenly mass scale is really an interesting thing to think about, and I think it goes with what with the next question, which is about international corporations. Mm. So, for example, Apple and Starbucks have used these types of energy to build and sustain their businesses. And we're wondering, in your opinion, how you see them surviving without using it the way they've been using it.
Well, although I'm certainly not keen on the way Apple and Starbucks and other big multinationals treat their tax responsibilities, which I think is, you know, desperately unfair and something that we really have to do something about. On the other side of the coin, Google, for example, which is another very big company like Apple, both Apple and Google are building very large server farms, very large data processing centers, which are driven by fire, what I like to call fire-free electricity, renewable electricity, by electricity generated by photovoltaics particularly, and also by wind. And they are doing this for very good business reasons. I mean, obviously they like to brag about it because it makes them look greener, which is good from their point of view, from the branding point of view. But it is actually a good business decision because these technologies are now so much cheaper and so much more reliable. And they do not have all the consequences, the side effects that you have. I mean, one of the interesting things about setting up a big photovoltaic array is that it costs you money at the beginning, but that's it. You then don't have, you have essentially zero running costs, very, very small maintenance costs, and you don't have fuel costs, you don't have the risk of increasing fuel prices or interruptions of fuel supply. It's no longer an issue. So there is a huge advantage to doing this for the companies, and the companies realize this. But a lot of other companies, of course, are still stuck in the old mindset that say that we've got to do it the old way because that's the way we always did it. And those companies are finding their business models getting increasingly unreliable. They're finding that they're taking on risk which they're not able to cope with. And their shareholders are getting spooked by this. So it is going to be very interesting in the next few years what happens to companies.
Yes. And another question I'd like to ask you is that in our bid to gain power for our economy, how can we ensure that equality and fairness with these countries we trade with?
This is a huge issue. I mean, the whole issue of inequity, even within cities, never mind between countries, is a major problem. And part of it does come down to the political process, where in countries like the UK and the US and a number of other of the richest countries, the electoral process has now been commandeered to such an extent by the extremely wealthy that they are able to get legislation which favors them to such an extent, particularly for taxes and for different kinds of taxes and also for environmental regulations that work very much to the detriment of the rest of us. And I would like to think there was some way to cope with this. Certainly one of them has to be that we have to put more thought into not only into the electoral process but also to the voting process. The UK, for example, is a dreadful example of an awful electoral system in which you can have people in one constituency who, I mean, there are most of the constituencies in England, certainly, maybe not Scotland and Wales, are called safe seats. Because all you have to be is nominated, and the assumption is that you are then going to get elected because of this so-called first-past-the-post electoral system. And in where I live, just outside London, in the home counties, it is an absolutely solid Conservative area. My vote is wasted if I don't want to vote Conservative. And the same is true for most of the constituencies in the country, which means that the voters are disenfranchised. They have no influence on who's going to represent them in Parliament. And it is a system. This is one of the reasons why the electoral process in the UK is in serious jeopardy at the moment. Because if you are elected on a ballot in which less than half of the people actually vote, how can you claim you've got a mandate? So we have a big problem. We've got to do something about it. And it's going to be, you know, people of the younger generation that are going to be most affected by this. So one way and another, I mean, people of my generation, they take care of us because we vote. The old pensioners, they look after us. But the young people who don't vote are not getting the attention of the politicians. And it's a big problem.
It's really interesting what you were saying. I was just thinking, what do you think is the role of, you know, a politician, or so to speak, in ensuring that, you know, when we trade with countries like Nigeria or countries that are not as doing well as the UK are, what's the role of, you know, that politician to ensure that the way we trade is fair and equal?
It's a very interesting question, and it depends an awful lot on what you're trading. I mean, there is, of course, the so-called fair trade movement, which is, I think, has historically been a very important way to level a playing field, so to speak, to make sure that the people who actually produce the bananas actually get the proceeds, rather than all the middle people who gather them up and process them and ship them and sell them.
We could relate this to energy and oil.
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, this is historically, of course, the big Western oil companies. There were originally seven of them. They called them the Seven Sisters, up until the early 1970s, and they had concessions from countries like the countries in the Middle East, in which the oil companies made all the money. The countries didn't. And then the countries finally decided that this was simply not going to be acceptable any longer. And they had an opportunity, because in 1971, the U.S., for the first time, became an oil importer. The U.S. had always been one of the key producers of oil from Texas and other places. But by 1971, it was using so much petrol, particularly oil for vehicles, that it started importing oil. And from that point on, the Western economies were vulnerable to action taken by the oil exporting countries. And of course, I was around, you weren't, but I was around in 1973 at the time when, as a result partly of another outbreak of war between Israel and other Middle Eastern countries, The countries that came together as what was called the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, in a matter of weeks, they succeeded. They imposed an embargo on oil shipments not only to the U.S. but also to the Netherlands, which led to gun battles at American gas stations, petrol stations, and they managed to increase the price of oil from what was then $3 a barrel to $12 a barrel, which was, you know, fourfold increase, which dramatically, you know, it shook the global economy was called the first oil shock, and so the whole world went into recession for a couple of years as a result of this. Although the countries that were selling the oil did very well out of it, and for the first time. So, and we've had this tension ever since between the countries that actually produce and export the oil, and the countries that are importing it, and of course the companies that are involved. So now it's not only the privately owned companies like ExxonMobil and Shell and BP, but it is also the national oil companies, the companies that are owned by the countries that are producing the oil. So there is this is a whole new political dynamic, and it's very complex.
Yeah, it's really interesting what you're saying, because you can see how politicians have the role, but also the voters have the role to ensure that they get the right person in to make the right decisions.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This is very important.
I was just wondering, what do you think this whole situation that we've been talking about now in terms of inequality and poverty and the role that oil and the distribution of oil plays, how do you think this would look like if sustainable energy was to come in the mix?
It's a very interesting question. A lot of people have pointed, and indeed a lot of people in the area have pointed out that the Middle East has an enormous resource of sunlight, that Saudi Arabia could be a major exporter of electricity if it wanted to be, producing electricity from photovoltaics. And the same is true for other Middle Eastern countries. So on the one hand, if we are serious about cutting down on the use of fuel, if we stop using so much fire and begin to need less fuel to do it, then this is something that countries like Saudi Arabia are very hostile to for perfectly understandable reasons, because it has been central to their whole economic structure. And, of course, one of the problems that the Saudi Arabian authorities face is that they have a very, very young population. They have a lot of very young people, and the young people do not have work. And the young people are, in many cases, a lot brighter than they're given credit for. And, of course, a lot of them are female, which in a country like Saudi Arabia, with its patriarchal structure, is a source of really, really deep tension, social tension. And the same is true in a number of the other countries in that area. And so historically, for the past, well, recently, the countries like Saudi Arabia have been able, so to speak, to buy off their population because they have such extravagant proceeds from selling oil internationally. So they have been able to keep the lid on social unrest simply because they can provide material goods to the people of the country. But if that becomes less available, if in the past year the price of oil has dropped precipitately from its high, and this has caused enormous social tensions in the countries that are exporting oil, because, as I say, in many of these countries, they have used the oil proceeds to buy off the social unrest, particularly from their young people. And if that is no longer feasible, then the authorities are going to have trouble. And my colleagues, I'm an associate fellow at a place called Chatham House, which is just up the street here. The world's first independent foreign affairs policy research institute. And this is an area that my colleagues spend a lot of time on. They watch this very closely because it is going to be a source not only of domestic but international conflict.
That's very interesting. I think the question that I'm going to ask kind of relates to what we're just saying, so if you don't mind if I ask the question. Sorry. What kind of policies, bearing in mind everything you've said, what kind of policies would you like to see to reduce fuel poverty within the UK, but generally as well internationally? What kind of policies do you think needs to be put in place, bearing in mind the issue that you've mentioned with Saudi Arabia and social unrest?
I think the crucial change of the way we think about this is to realize that what we do with things, and that the fire and the electricity and the fuel and so on is only part of the story. It's part of the system, and it's not the most important part of the system. The most important part of the system is the things, especially, for example, buildings. Now, in the UK, we have this problem that you mentioned called fuel poverty. It is because the buildings are so awful. It's because the buildings are flimsy, they have badly fitting doors and windows, they let the heat out almost. I grew up in a city in Canada called Winnipeg, where in the course of any 12 months, we would get some days when the temperature is 40 below Celsius, And some days when the temperature's 40 above. Everybody knows about the 40 below and the 2 meters of snow and so on. But they don't realize that in the summer, it's also very, very hot. And when I first came to the UK in 1960, I couldn't believe the buildings. Because if they had taken a typical UK London house and stuck it in my hometown in central Canada, everyone in the house would have frozen to death in a couple of days, because even with all the heaters running, because the heat just went straight out the windows and out the roof. So this is the mistake we made. We thought because fuel was cheap that we could skimp on the building and then use fuel to make up for the inadequate building. Use fire and fuel to make up for the inadequate building. And we have done that right across the board with the things that we have built, with the lamps and the motors and so on. We make them cheap and then use a lot of electricity and a lot of fire to make up for how bad the things are. Whereas if you do get the things right, I mean, we up until fairly recently, we were happy to put up with incandescent lamps that were designed originally in 1880, and which turned less than 5% of the electricity into light. Almost all of it was coming off as heat. As you know, if you burn your hand on an old incandescent light bulb. So, and we knew that we could do it better with fluorescent lights, and we now can do it dramatically better with LEDs, with light-emitting diodes. But the traditional people didn't want to make the change. They even insisted on being able still to buy these dreadfully wasteful, century-old incandescent light bulbs, just because that was what they were used to. And so this problem of mental mindset and inertia socially is one of the biggest problems we have to deal with, which is, again, why I wrote the new book, because I think we need a better story. We need a story that makes sense about the kind of future we should be looking for and the way to get there. And the thing is that it takes a long time to change what you call infrastructure, like buildings and so on, because that's a lot of, that's bricks and mortar and steel and concrete and so on. But minds can change overnight if you get a different perspective on this and think of it in a different way. And suddenly you see there's a whole range of opportunities you didn't notice.
I think I'm going to skip to the last question of this section because we're over running over. No, it's fine. But it touches on what you've been saying, so I think it's quite relevant. And it's sort of, how do you think the industry and government can collaborate to rethink energy and the way we use it?
I have been saying for a long time that The most important leverage that governments have is not legislation or regulation. It's because they are huge users of fuel and electricity. They're major customers, and their activities involve, for example, running. In the UK, we have, I think the UK government, I've seen a number that the UK government is responsible for something like 28,000 buildings. When you take into account its own offices and things like hospitals and schools and all the other premises, military bases, prisons, and there have been a whole succession of official reports pointing out for the past 15 years that these buildings are bad and getting worse. So if the government really wanted to make the kind of change that I'm talking about and shift the focus away from more fuel and electricity. The problem about the way we do it now is that we think about getting more fuel and electricity rather than getting the buildings right. And it's like opening the bath taps wider without putting the plug in. Mm. So if you shift the focus to start getting the things right, and the people who can do this for starters are governments. They can say, we want you businesses, you corporations, to offer us upgrades for our buildings. Tell us how you want to do it, how much it's going to cost, how many jobs it will create, what materials you'll need, what new sophisticated bits of technology we need to order. It would be a huge pump priming exercise for the new kind of corporate activity that I'm talking about. Because for starters, if you're going to do it with buildings, you've got to do it where the buildings are, and they're all over the country. So you will be creating new jobs, not just in London and the home counties, but all the way all over the UK, and skilled jobs, and some semi-skilled jobs as well, where people are ready to work and need the work. And at the same time, you offer good contracts to companies that have been looking for this kind of work but haven't previously had it available, and opportunities to order and bring down the cost of the modern, not only the photovoltaic panels and things like that, but all the control technology that you need. Information technology is going to be a hugely important part of this, because you can have buildings that run themselves, that you don't have to keep turning things on and off because they know whether you want it on and off, and so on. That you have the opportunity to do this so much better than we have done it before, just because we haven't, you know, we're set in the old way of thinking about this. And if we can, and so the opportunity for governments to do this, not only would it be a major opportunity of the kind I mentioned, but it would save us taxpayers money, because running the government costs a lot of money. And if you can run the government better, I mean the actual physical running of the government better, then we'll have more money to spend on the NHS, on education and things like that, which is what we're, where we really need to spend the money.
So sort of thinking about the future, I think, because we've only got like 5 minutes left, so I think maybe we should talk about the future, and that's our sort of last section, and because you've already touched on a lot of it.
I would like to know, what do you think is the future of energy in London?
I would like to think that it is going, that one of the big things that's happening in general is that we are getting away from the very large, lumpy kind of, particularly electricity supply, heat as well, but also but particularly electricity, to having much more local systems where you not only use the electricity, but you generate the electricity close to where you use it. So they're now talking about mini-grids and micro-grids, where you have a small local system which is under control of the local people and probably uses mostly local resources. And if you are generating your own electricity, you want to make sure you're not going to waste it, so you get your buildings right and your lamps and motors right as well, so that you get the whole, you start thinking in whole system terms. And we could do this in London. In fact, I have a very good colleague who was actually hired to do this in London more than 10 years ago. And then they had an election, and they threw out the old mayor and brought in the new one, and the new mayor immediately fired my colleague, which was, and his name is Alan Jones. He was instantly recruited by the city of Sydney in Australia. He spent 5 years working in Sydney, on contract in Sydney, and set up a huge program to turn Sydney into a sustainable city, with local generation, private wire electricity, private heat networks, massive upgrades of buildings, better lighting, LED lighting, street lighting, and so on.
Talking about Sydney, how far away do you think London is from being entirely powered on energy that's renewable and sustainable?
Probably a half a century, because of the size of the city. It depends to some extent on whether you try and generate the electricity all within the borders of London, which I think is probably not possible. But you will be able to generate it outside. I mean, we have already got offshore wind farms, which are bringing a great deal of electricity ashore. But you have, again, you have a running battle between people who want to keep doing it the old way. And in many cases, they're the powerful people. In many cases, they're the people who presently have the political power and the economic power. And they don't want to lose that power. They think they're going to lose that power, and they are therefore fighting their corner and frequently fighting dirty. And you have to keep it realize that that's why I call the subtitle of the book The Fight for Our Future, because it is a fight. It's a fight. I have what I call the fire feeders. The companies, and of course the people who support the companies, that are still making most of their money by producing fossil fuel. These people don't want to give it up, and in spite of the fact that they're endangering our future. So we have a fight on our hands, but it's a political fight, and it's a fight in which we now have an awful lot of allies, including, for example, as you mentioned earlier, the insurance companies and the reinsurance companies, very big financial players. are now on our side of the issue. So, you know, I wouldn't have said this 3 or 4 years ago, but I'm beginning to think we're winning.
Oh, that's good. That's good. That's positive. What sort of legacy would you like to leave future generations around energy?
I'd like to see us have human activity systems that actually function much more like natural systems. An old very good friend of mine, an American colleague called Amory Lovins, has a lovely example. He says there are three ways to make limestone into a good building material. You can cut it into blocks, or you can calcine it at 1200 Celsius to make cement, or you can feed it to a chicken, because eggshell, weight for weight, is one of the strong materials, the strongest materials we know. But we don't know how the chicken does it, and the chicken does it at a chicken's body temperature. It doesn't require 1200 Celsius. And we are so used to doing things with fire, with the very high temperatures that fire involves. We haven't really got to grips with the way biology works in these things, the way biological systems create materials that we can use. If we can figure that out, if we can get to the point where our human activity systems, including the materials processing and so on, actually start converging toward the way natural systems work, living systems work, then we'll be onto something. I think that's a really exciting prospect.
So I'd like to ask you, are you an optimist or pessimist when thinking about the future of energy?
I think I'm a realist. I'm by instinct, I mean, I know how bad things are and how much worse they could get. But I tend not to dwell on it, because I spent most of the 1970s working on policy issues related to plutonium, to the material which is used in nuclear weapons. And I became convinced, and I still am convinced, that there is a serious probability that we are going to do something really, really disastrous on the planet. But if you get into that mindset, you then really only have two choices. Either you blow your brains out or you give it your best shot. And ever since then, I've been working on the basis that I want to give it my best shot. Because we might still pull it off.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.